We've had some technical issues, but I am here, so all is well. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, October 24th, 2013, the 33rd day of autumn. We have lost 3 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 37 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. Sun rose 7:17 this morning. It will set at 6:01 this evening. We will have 10 hours and 44 minutes of daylight today. So the days are getting shorter. The shortest by comparison, December 21st and a few days around that, will be 9 hours and 14 minutes, which is just an hour and a half shorter than today. The moon will rise at 10:22 this evening. It will set at 12:57 tomorrow afternoon. We are 2 days short of last quarter. Next full moon is November 17th, which unfortunately does not fall on a program date, so I don't get the opportunity to howl on the air, one of my pleasures in life. Now our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. First off, Lance Corporal Christopher O. Grant, age 20, of Ridgewood, Louisiana. He is with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force, killed in combat in Helmand Province on October 20th. Now, Sergeant Lyle D. Turnbull, age 31, of Norfolk, Virginia, was not killed in war. He died. He was with the 11th Signal Brigade. He died from a medical emergency after participating in a 10-mile run at Camp Arifjan, I believe it is. It's hard to read those. Arifjan. Kuwait, actually, on October 18th. So he was running, and he died from that. A 31-year-old man, kind of unusual. And finally, Staff Sergeant Patrick Howard Quinn, age 26, of Quarryville, Pennsylvania, with the 10th Special Forces Group, was killed in combat in Paktika Province on October 13th. These three American servicemen were alive on the date of our last broadcast 2 weeks ago. Sergeant Turnbull actually died after a recreational activity, which could have been at home, but that's just the point. He did not die at home, but in Kuwait, thousands of miles from his loved ones. American men and women are at risk for grave injury and death at this moment, and every moment until the war comes to an end. Each death is a great loss to their family and to all Americans. I look forward to the day when the war in Afghanistan and this feature come to an end because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions and you have the right to disagree with them because everyone has the right to be wrong. Well, we're kind of busy today. We have three things to review, which we'll try to make short shrift of. We'll give them all their due, but we have an interesting guest today. We saw Captain Phillips, the movie with Tom Hanks, A Time to Kill, a Broadway play, and The Winslow Boy, a Broadway play as well. Give me a second. Okay, let's start with The Winslow Boy. We saw that on Broadway last week. This is an English play. It first played on Broadway in 1947, so it's quite old. It's the true story of a young British teen who is accused of stealing. He denies it and persuades his father, who persuades a well-known attorney, that he is innocent. Well acted and directed, but my question is, why remake a pretty good play? Are there no pretty good plays being written today which deserve notice? Well, Todd Haymes, the Roundabout Theater Company's artistic director, explains that he has personally wanted to produce this play for many years, and when he saw the British production, this particular British production at the Old Vic in London, he says he found the perfect production. So, the personal preference of a theater company's artistic director carries a lot of weight. Question answered. It's a well-done, well-written play for sure. Brings out human emotions we all know so well. We feel with the characters. We note that the passion for justice is more felt by the boy's father than by the boy himself, who just wants to go on with his life and pays little attention to the details. An interesting subplot involves Kate, sister to the boy, played by Charlotte Parry. She's being courted, and at one point Kate says of herself that she does not have much good looks. Well, then they should have gotten a different actress. We also see the father's obsession with fairness and his reaction when the verdict is announced. We share in all these characters' feelings and take a good theatrical journey with them. So again, I ask, are there no pretty good plays being written today? Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks, you all know this story, It's pretty much an accurate account of the piracy incident off Somalia in April 2009, where Navy SEALs were called in to terminate the situation. Well put together for the most part, and Hanks turns in his usual competent, sympathetic performance. Captain Phillips' ship was taken by pirates, and he was taken hostage on a lifeboat back in 04. I'm sorry, in 09. Fortunately for him and his crew, they were Somali pirates. Now, Somali pirates hold their hostages for ransom, then release them. In Nigeria, which is another problem area, hostages are murdered and the cargo sold off. Different styles. Craziness. I wondered why such a large ship could be taken over by men in glorified skiffs. The answer was they were forbidden to carry weapons, but that has changed since. Ships may, and I presume do, carry arms, which should be sufficient to repel such attacks today. One thing of interest that is brought out and fact checks out is that foreign fishing vessels have decimated the once fertile fishing grounds off Somalia, causing the native population to seek other means of making a living, however ignoble those means may be. And in fact, when Captain Phillips questioned one of these, the head pirate, he said, "We're fishermen." So that's quite interesting. It's a good movie, fairly close to the actual facts. I do recommend it, Captain Phillips, with Tom Hanks. And finally, last night we saw A Time to Kill on Broadway. My favorite, it's based on a John Grisham novel. My favorite drama is the kind that makes you laugh on the way to making deeper points, and this play does deliver on both counts. Sebastian Arcelius' spirited performance as defense attorney Jack Briggins keeps the action moving swiftly, and the 2.5 hours passed by quickly. Fred Dalton Thompson and Tom Skerritt, both well-known seasoned actors, do fine jobs as well. Mr. Thompson, you may recall, also served as U.S. Senator from Tennessee, and he was briefly engaged as a presidential candidate, a Republican conservative. This first of John Grisham's novels to be adapted to the stage was skillfully done by Scarsdale's Rupert Holmes. It tells the story of a black father who kills two men who raped and beat his 10-year-old daughter. He freely admits the crime, and it is the task of his attorney, Mr. Arcelus, to get him acquitted somehow. We don't know the verdict until it is read, so a bit of suspense as well. Mississippi's culture of racial bigotry figures prominently during the trial, as does some Perry Mason-esque legal gamesmanship. Some of the roles actually seem unnecessary. They probably were in the book, but I have not read the book, so I don't know. They seem to have outlived their usefulness in the stage version, though. Some serve minor purpose, but at least three parts could have been completely eliminated within in no way hurting the story at all. Patrick Page plays the prosecutor. He's a seasoned Broadway actor. He's got the strongest voice of all. He was as excellent here as he was as the Green Goblin in Spider-Man. And sorry to say, he's no longer there, so I will not get to see his excellent portrayal when I see Spidey in the near future for the third time. Well, A Time to Kill is good drama. It's well done, terrific sets and staging. I do recommend this play, A Time to Kill on Broadway, starring Tom Skerritt and Sebastian Arcelius and Fred Dalton Thompson. I think you'll enjoy it. Some of the other players were not quite great, but it does hold together. It's good. It's a good play. My guest today is Will Nicholas, Senior Regional Manager for the Northeastern U.S. of the Tesla car company. Now, as you may or may not know, the Tesla is the most highly rated and advanced all-electric vehicle, I presume, in the world. It's manufactured in California. Speaking to us today from the Consumers Union Test Track in Colchester, Connecticut, welcome Will Nicholas.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Good morning. Now, you said something about Lyme something. Isn't it actually Colchester or what?
Hey, excuse me, repeat that one more time. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I know you're on a cell phone. Is it actually Colchester, Connecticut? Or do I have that wrong?
Yes. So I'm actually in Connecticut today. We're doing a track day with several other internal combustion engine cars, just demonstrating how well an all-electric vehicle can perform.
Okay. And as we said, the Tesla is an all-electric vehicle. It is not a hybrid. There's no motor. I mean, there's an electric motor, but that's it. And yet it has a strong range of between 200 and 300 miles, and it goes 0 to 60 as well as any other car, right?
Absolutely, if not better. I mean, you think about electric motors and what we use them for traditionally on trains and elevators and construction cranes. We're able to produce a high amount of feet-pound of torque And for that reason, you know, with a car that weighs just over 4,000 pounds, it's able to move 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds, which is very impressive.
And how much of that weight is the batteries?
About just over 1,200 pounds is in the battery. And that battery compartment is actually in the floor pin of the chassis, which makes it have the lowest center of gravity of any sedan on the road and has a really even distribution of weight, which makes it really good in the corners and handling and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've driven them, of course. I would love to drive one of those cars. I just love the way they look. And coincidentally, when we first met at the Consumers Union exposition or whatever of hybrids and all electrics and economical cars, I actually saw one in the street that very day, which is interesting. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Elon Musk, the founder of the company. Didn't he get a start in PayPal?
Indeed, he was one of the co-founders of PayPal. And from there, after they sold to eBay, he was able to take some of that small fortune and invest it in Tesla and also some other ventures, including SpaceX, which is a private rocket company that is currently pushing rockets into space to dock with the International Space Station.
So are these all profit centers, or are some of them? I understand that Tesla has become profitable already after however many years, 10 years in the business, I think, right?
Indeed. Indeed, we actually we achieved our first profitable quarter at the beginning of this year and have been profitable since. So we see a huge amount of growth and opportunity as we continue to increase the production of our vehicles and come out with other products that will be more affordable to the mass market.
Now, by more affordable to the mass market, I recall that the price of these cars, the very rock bottom one was somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000, and the average vehicle was over $100,000. By affordable, what do you mean? What's the number?
So you are correct on those current figures, Bob. However, we have always planned to come out with a compact sedan that will be, you know, entering the market in between $35,000 and $40,000, and we'll have a 200-plus mile range. That's quite a few years away at this point, but something that's always been our goal from the beginning.
So compact sedan implies it won't have the pep and the top speed. Is that so, or am I just guessing at that?
No, we certainly want to, you know, have a performance aspect and a technology aspect, as well as safety included in all of our cars. It will just be a smaller car. So imagine Model S is comparable to a BMW 5 or 7 Series, mm-hmm. and our next generation vehicle will be more comparable to a BMW 3 Series, per se.
Well, those are peppy cars anyway.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Okay. And the range will still be over 200 miles.
That's our goal, yes, sir.
Which means, just for the audience who may be a little befuddled, that means between charges, like the range of a regular internal combustion car, like most of us have, when you fill up a tank, when do you have to fill it again before you go dry? And that's about what we're talking about with electric. Now, I know there's no way to compare. You're comparing apples with oranges if you say how much does electricity cost versus how much does gas cost. But I'm sure you've done that calculation. If the equivalent for 25 miles is a $4 gallon of gas, what would that same 25 miles cost in an all-electric vehicle?
So the calculations that we usually refer to our customers is to travel a full charge, so roughly 300 miles in a Model S, it costs you about $10 in electricity.
So 300 miles for $10?
Exactly.
Whoa.
So most Americans today drive roughly about 15,000 miles per year. In today's gas prices, that's going to cost them anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000, depending on what kind of vehicle they're driving.
Yeah.
In electricity, that would typically only cost someone about $500. So you're seeing, you know, several thousand dollars worth of savings every year when you're driving an electric vehicle.
Wow. Please get it down to $35,000 quick.
Indeed.
So 300 miles for $10, let me do some elementary arithmetic. That's 100 miles for $3.33. Right?
Yes, correct.
And okay, well, we don't have to go any further. That means if you drive 100 miles in one of these electric vehicles, it costs you $3.33. That's fantastic, fantastic. Okay, the battery technology is really the most important part of this, right? Am I right about that?
Yes, the lithium-ion battery pack and the AC induction motor are certainly Tesla's core competencies that really give us that secret sauce that's able to achieve us the range and performance and safety that we have on all of our vehicles.
Now, you didn't create lithium-ion. Did you somehow find a different way to use it that makes it more efficient?
Correct. So we did not invent the elements, you know, lithium, but we do use what we call an 18650 cell, which is very common in the industry. You see them in many consumer electronics. And what we've done is we've put thousands of those cells into a pack and surrounded them each with a liquid coolant that manages the thermal temperature really well and the energy as well. So we're able to achieve these long ranges, even on a heavy vehicle that's able to carry 4 or 5 adults.
Okay. Will, we have a caller. Let's see what he has to say. Good morning, caller.
Yes, it's Mr. Kim from New Rochelle.
Mr. Kim, hi.
You finally got to the money part, which is interesting here. I've lived in Europe and Australia for many years. The Germans, of course, have spent $8 a gallon for gas. Scandinavia's up to 10. I understand there's a place in Denmark where they have no fossil fuels at all. They get it from all the other sources and sell it to other areas.
Do you have a question, Mr. Kim?
The question is, shouldn't we be advocating for a $10 a gallon gas here so that this will become, the market will shift, and we'll use capitalistic supply and demand curve, and then everybody will be falling over themselves to get one of these marvelous little cars?
Great question. Will, can you tell us... how do you feel about that?
I would love to have those types of incentives to encourage consumers to purchase electric vehicles. That being said, there are ways to even make the electricity cheaper. And so right now, currently in the United States, depending on where you live, electricity is generated from a number of different forms, whether that be coal combustion or solar or wind or geothermal. So even if the gas prices stayed where they are, if we were able to leverage our energy usage to lean on some of the natural elements that can produce electricity, we could see the cost of electricity go down so much that even if gas prices were constant, you'd still see a considerable savings. Nice. But if the government or any other agency were to affect the price of gas to consumers, it would certainly only help my salespeople and move these cars out of the factory.
Terrific. Now, the fact that the first permanent charging station, of course, the biggest problem is you can't drive down the road and say, okay, charge your electric car here. They virtually don't exist. I mean, there are some, of course, but we don't see them. I've never seen one. The fact that the first station just opened in California within, I guess, the last month or so, and others hopefully will be joining soon, when do you anticipate that you can tell your customers you now can fill up on the road? Because I presume, by fill up I mean charge, I presume people who get the car get a charger to use at home. But other than short commutes and short trips, what's going to happen?
It's a great question, Bob. So currently what makes Model S so unique is the charger per se is actually on board the car. So what Model S comes with is a connector. And basically that's, you know, imagine a cell phone charger. One goes into the wall and the other end goes into the car. And so one of those comes with every car that we sell. And when people are, you know, traveling longer distance, so going more than 300 miles in any given day, there are public charging stations that are starting to become more prevalent. But Tesla has taken a stake in this claim and invested in what we call our supercharging network. So an average public charger will recharge one of our cars in about 8 to 10 hours. The superchargers that we've developed will charge a car 200 miles in 30 minutes. And we've started to implement those stations along the coastal areas. So at the end of this week, actually, you'll be able to drive from San Diego to Vancouver, hitting up all of our charging stations. And what's the best part for our customers is that they're absolutely free.
So
we're going to continue to do the same on the East Coast. So by the end of the year, for those folks that are traveling down to Florida, for the holiday season, you should be able to drive from Maine all the way down to Miami as long as we, you know, meet all of our time targets for putting these charging stations in. At this point, we've already seen some open up in two parts of Connecticut, in Darien and Milford. We have some others in Newark, Delaware. We have many coming online this month, both in Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
Funny, I was just in Newark a couple of weeks ago, and so I know it's not pronounced Newark. It says Newark, but it's Newark. And then there's something also L-E-W-E-S, which we want to say Lewis, but it's Lewis. Okay. So Tesla itself is driving the construction of these charging stations then.
Indeed. We want to take as much risk off the consumer. We want it to be as easy to buy an electric car as it is an internal combustion engine.
Right.
And although there's tons of gas stations, almost at every corner, there's certainly more outlets. And we recommend that every time you're in your garage, you should simply just plug in, because if you had a gas station in your garage or on your driveway that costs, say a quarter a gallon, you'd probably be topping off all the time.
Sure.
So you can actually, even though it takes longer to charge a car, you can do many other things in that time, whether it be sleeping or spending time with your family.
Right, like overnight, if you plug something in at 8 o'clock when you come home from work, something, and you unplug it and you're ready to go at 6 o'clock in the morning, is that a full charge?
Absolutely. Yes,
okay,
sir.
No problem. Okay, Elon Musk is quite a fellow. He is sending, as you say, private rockets into space. He has given away, he's the one who recently designed that tube transport thing, which he says he's not going to make it, but here's the design, go ahead and do it. And he's also given the technology away and just saying, look, this is how you make electric cars, do it, just as an environmental plus. Is he really this kind of a spiritual super guy? There's no profit motive there? Or is he rich enough? He says, you know what, let me make the world a better place before I die. What's he about?
I think that meeting Elon a few times, he certainly is a visionary. And the phrase, I think, coined by Teddy Kennedy back in the day, don't see things and ask why, but rather see things that are not and ask why not. So I think that he's able to take a look at our world from a different perspective, mm-hmm. and imagine better ways in which we can live in it.
Wow.
And he had three goals in order to kind of progress the way people interact over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to, take a hydrocarbon community and turn it into solar electric.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also wanted to, expand the human footprint beyond the planet Earth. So he's in many ways already achieved some of those goals. And I appreciate, as well as many others, how he continues to push the envelope in different industries and in different ways.
Okay, he seems like a cool guy, and so do you, Will. We have to cut it right now. I hope I'll speak to you in the future. I have many more questions to ask you. Thanks very much for being on.
Absolutely. Have a good morning. Cheers.
Okay, you too. Thanks to Will Nicholas for joining us at Environmentally Sound this morning. Our thought for the week, it is easier to fight for one's principles than to live up to them. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station. I have not seen Howard. Don't know if he'd be on. I am Bob Levensold, chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
AM 1460 WVOX New Rochelle. Stay tuned for Fox News.
Oh, I'm Dave Anthony. It's getting testy at a